When I was about as tall as my father's elbow, as he judiciously bent it in the 9 taverns of our town, I saw a lot of the spirits of the American West, a good deal of them liquid. Among his own many Western aspects, he'd been a homestead kid, bronc buster, sheep herder, short order cook. My father was a haymaker, a haying contractor, a kind of freelance foreman who would hire his own crew and put up the hay for a rancher for so much per ton. Those saloons, where I was lucky enough to tag along with him, were his hiring halls, and as he would sound out a hay hand on whether the guy had ever run a power buck rake and where, there would be the ritual of the men fumbling into their shirt pockets for the little white tobacco sack and book of rolling papers, Bull Durham and a Bible, as they called the cigarette papers. The makings of the hand-rolled cigarettes they smoked as they talked of haystacks and summer wages. Social ingredients are the butter cookies of memory, and just as that famous nibble into a bit of French pastry set Proust off into volumes of intricate remembrance of things past, we ought to, in our own remembrance of things West, try to see all of what's been made since back there at the makings, to see how the spirits we grew up with endure and drift and change. That blue smoke of sociableness, as my father and his hay hands lit up in the Maverick bar, I reported in this house of sky this way. Opening the door from the street was like finding yourself in a sudden roaring fog. In the novel about today's West that I'm working on now, the sulfur whiff of the past comes to my protagonist in the streets of San Francisco, where he and his estranged, punk-haired 25-year-old daughter have been rollerblading. She lights up, shoos her smoke away from him, says she didn't mean to second-hand him, and he thinks to himself, "My God, it has come to this. People who will not give you the ice off their heart apologize for letting their cigarette smoke touch you." Quite a number of us out West are, I think, trying to do what writers have always done and pay homage to our native place, in our words. We're not the first to sit around inside our heads all the time and monkey away at that. James Joyce evidently didn't stop being an Irishman when he moved to Paris, or we wouldn't have Ulysses. And I've always liked Paul Horgan's saying, whenever he'd get too tired of always getting called a Southwestern writer, "Everybody is a regionalist," Horgan wrote. "Tolstoy is a regionalist." Before the West began to hear from its first couple of generations of writers actually born and raised out here, literary tourists pretty much had their way with us. Books set out here on the west side of America didn't give much attention to the workaday life and the valid voices of our region. A romantic version that one scholar called "The Cowboys Without the Cows" got underway at the start of this century with "The Virginian," Owen Wister's famous novel. The Virginian began a lineage of books that might be called Westerns. In a Western, a bad guy insults a good guy. In the Virginian, the actual insult is, "You son of a blank." And the good guy dangerously drawls back, "When you call me that, smile." But that's about all that does go on in a Western. None of the guys, good or bad, seems ever to do a lick of everyday work. Milk a cow, churn butter, plant a potato. You get the impression that somewhere just out of sight, there must be a catering service, maybe someplace around Omaha, that comes out west and feeds everybody and does the chores. So, those of us from the West of women homesteaders and male school marms, the West of people who came to build rather than to gunsling, to work but to dance and laugh along with it, We've had to write our way past the Virginian and his later heftier cohorts, Louis L'Amour and John Wayne. Bear in mind that it was only yesterday, historically, when the cultural images of the West were those two guys with a pound of belt buckle trying to hold up 25 extra pounds of gut. Something had to give way. And it did, and it has, with a considerable nudge from the singing teachers of those of us who write prose, our betters, the poets. Instead of bang, 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 listen to this from the late great Oregon poet William Stafford. They call it regional, this relevance, the deepest place we have. In this pool forms the model of our land, a lonely one, responsive to the wind. Everything we own has brought us here. From here we speak. In my own case, when I was still down there in the vicinity of the elbow, a new relevance in my life, a kind of Northern Lights out loud compared to the rambled through West that was my father, began to speak to me. You're not sugar nor salt, nor nobody's honey, so the rain will never hurt you, she crooned to me. That one goes around looking like she's been yanked through a knothole backwards, she huffed about our worst-dressed neighbor. And she confided about the couple dallying together in our wide-eyed little town. Those two were as close as three in a bed with one kicked out. Into my life had come that river of proverbs, my grandmother. I was 10 years of age, but my ears were as old as sin. All of a sudden, I knew I was in new territory of life, something like honorary adulthood. Now, besides my Scots Burr storytelling widower father, here was my mother's mother in this reluctant knot of bloodline they had made to raise me. So, you bet, my ears were busy from then on with the picture play of words from my grandmother, whose formal education had broken off at the third grade. Whenever the prairie wind would swirl up her dress and she would announce, "Balloon ascension," or with the bloodstream music of rhyme when my father, from the heights of his eighth grade education, would ask, "Have they taught you this one yet?" and begin reciting to my dropped jaw, "Hiawatha." It lasts. We've known so ever since art began to dance off the cave walls to us. Literature perhaps begins there, in the painted bison running in the tunnels of time, the hunting escapades they represent being told around the fire. I think that's what we're still up to, in the white canyons of paper, and now the nebulae of cyberspace. I think stories still can be our way of sharing light, sitting together around humanity's fire, with the universal dark all around us. Our work, our words, of course, have to start on the cave walls between our own ears, the everyday life of the writer. In my case, I probably reveal something in Bucking the Sun when I have the Fort Peck taxi dancer Proxy Shannon ask her new companion of the night about his suspicious political background. "Darius, if they pin something on you, will any get on me?" In my everyday work as a writer, I see it as my job to try to get words on people. On my characters first, people who are poor in all else are often rich in language. The everydayness of that pair of imaginative tongues I grew up around must have drilled that into me, because from my very start as a book writer with this House of Sky, I've always tried to attain a language which makes a shimmer behind the story, the appeal, the wonder of the vernacular of people's lives coming through. Any kind of work has its own vocabulary, its poetry beneath the prose. By listening, by looking things up, once in a while by a little lucky making things up, people and their everyday treasury of language can be brought to life on the page, I believe. Here's one of my efforts from English Crick, the scene where the forest fire on the Two Medicine National Forest is just starting to get nasty. The narrator, 14-year-old Jake McCaskill, the forest ranger's son, hears the party line telephone ring. I called out to my mother, "I'll rub her," which is the party line phrase for eavesdropping, listening in. Rubber ear, I think, has something to do with this. The voice on the line was my father himself. "It is an ornery son of a bitch of a fire," he was informing the dispatcher, Chet. "Every time a person looks at it, it looks a little bigger. We better hit it hard. Get hold of Isidore and tell him to bring in a camp set up. Tell Great Falls we need 50 Fs, emergency firefighters, that abbreviation is. 50 Fs and a timekeeper for them, Chet." "Say again on that F request, Mac," queried Chet. "1-5 or 5-0? 5-0, Chet. Pause. Chet was swallowing on the figure. With crews of emergency firefighters already on the Chinese Wall fire and the fires down in the Lewis and Clark Forest, two headquarters in Great Falls was going to greet this request for 50 more, like the miser meeting the tax man. "Okay, Mac," Chet mustered. "I'll ask for them. What else can I get you?" Chet could not have realized it, but this was his introduction to the golden rule of a veteran ranger such as my father when confronted with a chancy fire. While you're getting, get plenty. If novelists do have an advantage in getting at anybody's souls, I believe it's there in the million element experiment called language. The process is far from automatic. A writer can't simply lens in on the people of Reno or Provo or Shoto like a frontier photographer and become an instantaneous soul stealer. The money isn't that easy, I regret to report. Because the alchemy of language carries with it the high probability of fizzle. Faulkner's own townspeople, after all, were being plenty clever with the language when they took a look at their squirrely local author and concluded there was only a letter or two of difference between that and squirrely, and dubbed him Count No Count. But the Mississippian's characterization of Faulkner has fizzled away, while his of them burns on and on. Well, they call it regional, this relevance. But there's an ingredient by which I believe writers can move the central power of literature to where they are in the world. This bit of makings of spirit, let us call the crocodile factor. Like so much else that has to do with the heart and soul of the American West, I owe this bit of writerly psyche to the late Richard Hugo, the bigger-than-life poet of Washington and Montana. In teaching aspiring poets, Dick Hugo used to advise, "When in doubt, throw in a crocodile." Among the things he meant by that are a list of pretended assumptions that he would use when he set out to write a poem. As Hugo told it in his terrific book on writing, The Triggering Town, "Whenever I see a town that triggers whatever it is inside me that wants to write a poem, I assume at least one of the following." And I'll give you just a few from his long list. "I am an outcast returned. Years ago, the police told me to never come back. But after all this time, I assume that either I'll be forgiven or I will not be recognized. On Saturday nights, everyone has fun but me. I sit home alone and listen to the radio. I wish I could join the others, though I enjoy feeling left out. The town was once supported by mining, commercial fishing, or farming. No one knows what supports it now. Hugo's kind of adjuration to the imagination is said many ways, probably in all forms of art. When the great carver Bill Reed was asked why his tribe, the Haidas, were the preeminent artists of the Northwest Coastal Tribes, he said the Haidas simply outcrazied everybody else. But I've always liked Hugo's crocodile prescription. I think it covers a lot of otherwise unexplainable wonders of prose, too. The go-for-broke elements that come right up off the page and get you. I tried to write about that a bit in Hard Earth, the book that brought me back to the Southwest where my life turned when I was 5 years old. Here's the section from Hard Earth of my father and my mother and I, Montana ranch people to the bone, fetching up in the winter of 1944 in a borrowed cabin in the desert outside Wickenburg, Arizona. Neighbors now consisted of lizards and scorpions. The mountains wavering up from every horizon looked ashen, dumpy. No pelt of sagebrush to soften this country for us either. Saguaro cacti, with their spiky mittens out, stubbled the hills. Where the familiar black green of Montana's jack pines would have shadowed, here the bare green blush of Palo Verde barely inflected the gulches, arroyos. And under every other bristling contortion of vegetation, prickly pears crouched like shin-hunting pygmies in ambush. Even the desert bird sounds had a jab to them, the ha-ha of a gambel's quail invisibly derisive in the bush, the yap of a Gila woodpecker scolding us from his cactus penthouse. I loved every fang and dagger of it. Any bloodline is a carving river, and parents are its nearest shores. At the Faulkner Creek Ranch in Montana, I had learned to try out my mother's limits by running as fast as I could down the sharp shale slope of the ridge next to the ranch house. How I ever found it out without cartwheeling myself to multiple fractures is a mystery, but the avalanche angle of that slope was precisely as much plunge as I could handle as a headlong 4- and 5-year-old. The first time my visiting grandmother saw one of my races with the law of gravity, she refused to ever watch again. Even my father, with his survivor's eye view from all the times life had bunged him up, even he was given pause by those vertical dashes of mine, tyke roaring drunk on momentum. But my mother let me risk. Watched out her kitchen window my every wild downhiller, hugged herself to bruises while doing so, but let me. Because she knew something of what was ahead? Can it have been that clear to her, that reasoned? The way I would grow up after was contained in those free fall moments down that shale-bladed slope. In such a plunge, if you use your ricochets right, you steal a kind of balance for yourself. You make equilibrium moment by moment, because you have to. Amid the people and places I was to live with, I practiced that bouncing equilibrium and carried it on into a life of writing, free-falling through the language. Specific geographies, but galaxies of imaginative expression. It is my conviction that writers can, yes, ground ourselves in specific land and lingo, and yet be writing of that larger country, life. I'm reminded of what another writer, who lived and worked far from the supposed literary centers of the world, once said about what he hoped was the worth of his own writing. He was an African novelist named Kamaraleya. Born in Guinea, he lived the last part of his life in exile in Senegal, where he died in 1980. An interviewer asked how it was to work so far away from other writers, away from the literary power centers, the Parises, the New Yorks, the Londons, the usual suspects. Kamaraleya responded that he thought the cultures of the world, as expressed in their writers, were all participating in one vast dance, each with its own special movement, each contributing something significant to the total world rhythm. I can hear that in our own Western pages. To me, that is the ultimate region, the true home for a writer, that vast dance. For if we dance them right, our words and stories, they are something more than words and stories about the West. They are heartbeats of the world.